words. I hope you said nice things. I hope you can see. I have to stand on one side or the other for all of this. I'm really glad to be here. It's the first time I've been to Norway. And I realize that... Can we open a few windows so it stays cool? Good.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm in a very unusual position. And the other night, at home, actually, in the United States, I was thinking about, you know, why should you listen to me? Well, one of the reasons is because I've been intimately involved with these scientists who have actually done this work, literally in day-to-day contact over about 8 years. The other reason is that I'm one of the few people who've actually seen a crop circle happen with my own eyes. And we're going to talk about that later on. Can we get these lights off now so that we can see the slides? What do you think? Oh, it's downside. So what we're going to do is talk about the science first. Thank you. Talk about the science first, and exactly what the work has been, what we've done, what we found, and what we think it means, and why we think that. And then, later on, I'm going to talk about my personal encounters, and show you some incredible photographs, light phenomena, which we've been gathering for some time. Now, the BLT team began in about 1991, and it was comprised of three people to begin with. John Burke, who was a New York businessman, who had a strong avocational interest in electronics and electrical matters. William Levingood, who is a biophysicist from the University of Michigan. And myself, I'm a T in BLT. We picked this name. I never thought this was going to go anywhere. And so BLT is a sandwich in the United States, bacon, lettuce, and tomato. And I put these together because I thought it was funny. And I never realized this whole thing was going to grow the way it has. People make fun of the name now in the United States. But they remember it, and you know, even bad advertising is good, they say. Since that time, those early years, we worked together, the three of us, for, I think, 8 years. And during that period of time, we sampled hundreds of crop circles all over the world. Not just in the United States, but in Canada, in England, in Poland, in Israel, in Australia, Germany, etc. The work that we're going to talk about first is all from that early era. Then we're going to talk about a recent study that we've just completed looking at soil crystallinity. Now I push it forward or make it go. Aha, that's how I do it. These buttons on the front?
Yeah.
Okay. Over those years, what we've done is looked at all kinds of formations. You will hear in the literature, or in people who talk about all this, that only simple circles are genuine. Well, our work does not indicate that. We have looked at simple circles like this one. Well, not a simple circle, but a relatively uncomplicated one. And we've also looked at very complex events like this. In addition, we have looked at many of these much less geometric events and at this randomly bound material that you see around it. You don't regularly see this in the photographs because the photographers take these pictures so that you will buy them. And so they try to cut out all this randomly down because people don't find it attractive. As a matter of fact, this material occurs around a great many crop circles, and we discovered that it was in fact significant. Here's an area in British Columbia from last summer where it was all randomly down. And as you'll see later on, many of the same changes that we found in the plants in the organized events are also found in these totally randomly found events. Here are two of our workers. This is Silbury Hill in southern England. And here we have Stan Lobb from England and one of the guys from California, part of our team. We have about 700, maybe 800 field workers now in countries all over the world. And we meet not just in England, but in other places, and to do the work. They're down on their hands and knees doing soil samples there. In Canada, we have another one of our field workers measuring out a formation The work is very regimented. There's a very strict protocol that we follow. And it involves measuring the thing first and photographing very carefully. Then we do a lot of compass work and very precise sampling depending on what event we're trying, what study we're doing. The work involves plants usually. And here we have some of the plant samples coming out of one formation. Frequently we take as many as 2,000 of these samples. In the bags we have the dirt from the soil. When these formations occur overseas, I mean for us, I mean anywhere outside the U.S., all of the plants have to be dried down, sometimes for 3 or 4 weeks before they're shipped in order to avoid opportunistic mold. This is a formation in Holland. It's a friend of mine's garage. And these they had to be hang up there for about 4 weeks before they were shipped. This happens all over the world. They have to rent barns or garages or whatever because we can't ship them when they're wet. This is William Levingood. He has a master's degree in biophysics from the University of Michigan. He did a great deal of work on his PhD, but never was actually awarded it. You will hear people or see people in writing refer to him as doctor. That's incorrect. In the United States, you don't call somebody doctor unless they have the PhD. But he has been a practicing scientist his entire life. One of the first discoveries that Levingood made from the very beginning were these enlarged nodes. We have a normal node here on the left. This is typical of what we find in the crop circles. This is the top node on the plant. The first node beneath the seed head is called the apical node, and we frequently find that it is elongated compared to the normal controls outside the formation. We take the samples not only inside, but of course outside the formation also. And then we compare to see what we get. When you measure thousands of these nodes, as we do, you then run a statistical analysis to see whether or not there's any difference, and is it statistically significant. After having done thousands and thousands and thousands of these, we know that the apical node on the top of these plants is usually elongated, statistically elongated, over the normal controls. This is to show you what the normal, this is a wheat, these are samples of wheat here, and those are normal nodes. And here we have the elongated nodes. This is a massively elongated situation. This is over 200%, and you don't see a 200% elongation in most crop circles. We figured that somewhere around 35 to 40% generally is statistically significant. Depends a great deal on whether these plants are sampled immediately after the formation occurs or whether we wait a period of time, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. Let's take one particular crop circle. It was at East Meon in England, and we sampled it straight across one of the diameters. And here's the sampling diagram. What we're looking at, the white here is down crop. We did both the standing and the down right across the formation. This was back in 1995, I think. And as you can see from the graph below, we're looking at node length, and here are the samples themselves. The red dots indicate down crop. And as you can see from this, there was a massive node elongation in all of the down crop. The green dots, which represent standing crop, did not have any node elongation. This is fairly typical of what you see in crop circles that include both down and standing crop, but it is not always the case, as we will also discuss. This is that case, look here. Can you just barely see the nodes here at the top? This is this case in British Columbia, a randomly downed event, no geometry to it at all, and yet the nodes are elongated. As you can see, their controls on this side are quite small. The point being here that whatever this situation is, it does not always produce geometric designs. In fact, quite frequently it doesn't. And even when it does produce geometric designs, they are not always elegant or beautiful. Frequently they're fairly gawky looking. We discovered later on that not only in simple circles like this particular one is from Paulding, Ohio, where you have an entirely flattened area, but also in events like this where you have standing centers, that node length change hit a law in physics known as the Beer-Lambert principle. The Beer-Lambert principle discusses the absorption of electromagnetic energy by matter. It predicts precisely what will happen to the matter as it absorbs certain amounts of electromagnetic energy. What we discovered was, well, again, we're losing the top one, but in planets that have a standing, or in circles of a standing center, as we have here, and in the top graph, there was no standing center. As we sample out towards the edge of the formation, these are the node length changes. And as you can see, they fit very tightly. You've got a very linear line there. This is what the Beer-Lambert principle predicts. Finding this sort of a relationship indicates that what caused those changes was electromagnetic energy. This is not people's planks and boards. This does not happen in manually flattened, mechanically flattened crops. We discovered in the United States back in 1997 an even more interesting fact. In this particular formation, and notice here again the randomly downed in the corner, that these changes can occur in standing crop also, not just in the down crop. In this event, and here I think you can see this line, this is the one of the control lines, and there was another one taken off in this direction. And in the controls, we found this very tight, consistent plot that the node length here, right at the edge of the formation, was decreasing as a function of distance away from the event. In other words, the energies in this case spilled over and out into the standing crop. If you were to randomly sample standing crop, you would never find a tight linear relationship like that. We do find it now. We never knew to look before, but we see this every so often. The energies apparently go beyond the down confines, out into the standing crop. When you hear these questions about hoaxers, the very first answer you can give them is, how do you do it then in standing crop? If you are saying that you made the circle, how did you create these node length changes in the crop outside? They don't have a good answer for that one. Another of the early findings was effects on the seeds in these plants. Now this varies enormously depending on the type of crop involved. I mean, as you know, crop circles occur largely in cereal crops, but they also occur in many others, including vegetables and full-grown corn. And it also depends on the age of the crop at the time it happens. The seed, of course, develops over the season. In this particular event, which was the Barbary Castle Triangle, which if you know anything about crop circles, you may remember, an extremely elaborate, very dramatic one, it wasn't sampled. And by the time it was, these are the controls, and these are the samples themselves. In the samples, there were no seeds. This particular formation had affected those plants so severely that the seeds never developed. Here we have a number from another formation. Again, on the top we have the samples. On the bottom we have the controls taken outside. And this was a case that had been sampled right away. The seed development stopped completely at the time that the energy hit the plants. There was no more development. Now, when you have seeds that are dehydrated like that, as again they are here in corn, what happens is that they don't germinate normally. If it happens early on and very severely, you get almost no germination at all. Here we have corn showing you the samples. At the same time, I think this is 7 days, I can't see. And here are the controls. A massive difference in their reproductive capacity. And even a more severe case, we're looking at the controls here. And here are the samples. As you can see, most of them haven't germinated at all. In other words, some component of this energy system can completely interfere with the capacity of the plant. That's pretty serious, because if in fact the seeds are all gone, what do you plant next year for food? if in fact crop circles occurred all over the world simultaneously in our fields, and they occurred at a very early growth stage, clearly we'd be in trouble. It's one of the reasons we thought this was interesting enough to study. Another variation that we discovered in the germination capabilities was that in certain hybrids, you regularly will find this reduced germination. But in non-hybridized seeds, where you get it's natural for these plants to grow variously, so that on any given day you might find some plants that would be a foot and a half tall, others which might be, say, 6 inches, and that would be perfectly normal. Not in hybridized, but in the non-hybridized. Seeds taken from crop circle plants that are not hybridized show this very synchronized growth. It's not normal. Here's the controls here where you have completely variable growth. And look what's happened to the formation seedlings. Somehow those seedlings have been synchronized to grow at a completely consistent rate, not the normal variable growth rate. We haven't studied this enough. A great deal more work needs to be done to understand what's going on there. But we have seen this many times. The perhaps most interesting germination change is one that did occur in this particular formation and in many others. It happens later on in the growth season when the seed is fully formed before the crop circle energies hit the plant. And although those seeds will be markedly dehydrated and will weigh less, they germinated up to 5 times the rate of normal and have a number of other very interesting results. Here again, can that be focused a little better? Do I have the way to do that? There we go. If you look at the bottom, you see the controls, and we have an increased growth rate here in the samples themselves. I'm sorry that these photographs aren't as good as they could be. Levingood took these, and he's not a photographer. He really is much more of a lab person. But here's a little bit better, a little clearer evidence. Here again on the right, we have the controls and a varied increased growth rate inside. The center of the circle, in this case, growing very vigorously. The edge, less so. This varies a lot from circle to circle. You may see that the edges are growing vigorously, the center not at all. But different than always, the controls. Looks one way. In this case, again, the controls, you have a depressed growth rate in the center and an increased growth rate at the edges. Remember that these illustrations represent many, many cases. This is not a single case, but this is something we find repeatedly and illustrate it with one single case. Once that had been discovered, Levingood realized that if we could replicate that, or if anyone could replicate it, the agricultural community, farmers, would find this of great interest. Anything that would increase the growth rate and perhaps yield would be extremely valuable. An accident in the lab, which we're looking at here, led to the discovery that made it possible for us to discover those energies and how to replicate them. These are samples taken from a crop circle in California, which had been shipped to the lab while they were green because we wanted to do a particular test that we do. So we shipped them overnight. Levingood took the clippings that he needed from the various samples and put them all back in a box in the lab, which he meant to throw out. But as frequently happens, some 10 days later, he discovered the box in the corner of the lab, opened it up, and to his surprise, remember there's no water and no sunlight given to these plants at all during those probably 12 days, but it took a few days to get there. These are the controls, and as you can see, they're dead as doornails. But this here were the samples growing totally vigorously, as if they had full sunlight and full water. This was absolutely intriguing, and Levingood, whose background is in ionic transfer in plants, realized that this had something to do with a response to electrical stimulus. John Burke, at this time, had been very interested in energies which he believed were present at Indian mounds, at pyramids, many other ancient and sacred places. He had been taking seeds and placing them on Indian mounds for a very specific period of time, and then letting them germinating them in the lab. He had also been taking magnetometer readings at many of these sites and discovered very specific magnetic abnormalities at the mounds, on things like the Serpent Mound in Ohio, Cahokia in Illinois, various sites in the Southwest, and here, these are at Michigan, these are mounds there, Indian mounds there. And what you see is the form, these are the controls here. Here are the samples that were placed on top of these Indian mounds in Michigan. Lo and behold, they produced this increased growth rate. And this is a case from Tikal in Guatemala. He made it his business to visit a number of these sites. And it was quite a long time, it took years to discover this, because you had to use indigenous seeds. You had to find exactly the right spot to place it. And the magnetometer readings apparently helped him discover this. And then you had to figure out how long to leave them. It turned out that exposure past a certain period of time did nothing. And if you didn't expose them long enough, it did nothing. But if you got it in the right range, you'd get the same effect. And here you have the controls. And here are the samples germinating away like crazy. All of this led to him and Levengood doing, through trial and error, a number of experiments with pulsed electricity. What they eventually discovered was a certain precise amount of energy to be given to these seeds would consistently produce, at least in certain varieties, this increased growth rate. These are the seeds treated by their machines called the MIR process, and it has now been patented, and they're trying to sell it to the agricultural community. Not only do they get increased growth, they find increased yield, and these plants will do it without water and without sunlight for long periods of time. In other words, they're much hardier than normal seed. Now, the farmers, of course, find this very interesting because they have to deal with drought and other problems constantly, and anything that can alleviate that or mitigate it makes this process very interesting. Can you open that window again? I don't want to get too much in here. Were the discovery of these small expulsion cavities. These are holes generally blown out at the number two node down the plant stem, the second node beneath the seed head. Although in recent years we're seeing them in the third and fourth nodes, and in full-grown corn we're finding them in 8, 9, 10 nodes in one plant. There seems to be an increase in the amount of energy that is being expended at crop circle sites. So here we have a beautiful example of an expulsion cavity in wheat. It was found, as were many, many other samples, in this particular formation in England a couple of years ago. And I think you would agree that that's not a simple crop circle. That's a fairly complex one. And yet it was filled with expulsion cavities all the way through it. Happened early in the season. It was a place called the Adam and Eve Stone. And I was particularly fond of it because many of the crop circle people had been saying that this only happens in simple circles. That the complex ones, which of course indicate a more sophisticated situation, never had these. Well, everybody in England that summer could easily see it if they bothered to look at the plants. We also have them here in barley. These are the expulsion cavities, and here again are the normal plants. This is from a case in the United States. Expulsion cavities appear to occur in about 25 to perhaps 35% of crop circles worldwide, at least in that percentage of the ones we've examined. It's very hard to talk about all crop circles because no one in the world has had the money or the time to examine all crop circles in all countries at even one season, much less over the entire period. All we can do is extrapolate from the data that we have. And it looks to us from our work that some 25 to 35% of crop circles worldwide may exhibit these expulsion cavities. Now, how this is happening is that something, and we think it's probably microwaves, is heating up the moisture inside the plant stems. It happens very quickly, in a nanosecond. It's an extremely intense energy. And what happens is the moisture at the top of the plant, or throughout the entire plant, turns to steam. At the top of the plant, you have very pliable, elastic tissues. It's the youngest part of the plant. And as the steam seeps out, it stretches those nodes, leaving them permanently stretched. Farther down the plant stem, the steam builds up, the tissues are much more rigid. They're not elastic, they're not pliable, and they finally burst the hole right through. This is what we think is going on. We've been able to replicate this by exposing plants to microwave radiation, and it produces these same effects. And so it looks to us that we have both a very good argument for the presence of some sort of electrical pulsing in crop circles, and also the presence of microwave radiation. Here's the same case that we looked at earlier, and this is the expulsion cavity count, and here are some of the expulsion cavities that we found in it. And what you see very clearly is that there were expulsion cavities in almost every single one of the down samples, and none present again in the standing crop. Another case in England a couple of years ago that I wasn't able to sample this one entirely, but I did gather some samples. And again, we have elongated nodes found in this formation and massive numbers of expulsion cavities. And again, it's a moderately complex event. I think this may startle you. If it doesn't, it certainly startled me. This formation in Holland some years ago, we sampled this. Now, I would assume, and did assume when we sampled it, that it was highly likely that it was man-made. But this is what we found. Can you lower that just a teeny little bit so they can see the expulsion cavities at the top? There, right there. This is what we found in that heart. And I'm talking here about the down crop that outlines the heart and the arrow. Now, I hardly knew what to make of that. I still don't really know what to make of it, except that after 8, 9, 10 years of work, hundreds of formations, thousands of plant samples, if any of this work means anything, then it means that this thing also was the real McCoy. It has to mean that, or none of our work means anything. People warn me about using this slide, but I think if you're going to tell the truth to people, you go ahead and tell the truth. And that's in fact what we found. Levengood doesn't like that. He's very uncomfortable with that. there's this evidence of some sort of increased energy exposure at crop circle sites, evidence in corn. This is maize. Do you call it maize here? Some 3 years ago now, I guess, in Indiana, was the first time we had ever seen this. We had had many crop circles, particularly in the U.S., in maize, but they had never shown expulsion cavities. There's an enormous amount of moisture, obviously, inside a corn stalk, and they're quite big. They're an inch and a half thick, but you can't break them easily, but there's a lot of moisture. In this particular event, which is a five-circle event in southern Indiana, there were, again, these expulsion cavities found. And I took photographs immediately because it was the first time I'd heard of it. Here's what they look like on the inside generally, not always, but generally. You find that the corn, and this is about, okay, is that better? I mean, this is maybe 7-8 feet tall, and the plants are swirled perfectly. This particular case, by the way, comes from Holland. This is one of the ones that Robert, whom you may have heard about, a witness as it was formed near his house. However, last summer, the whole game got just a little bit more bizarre. This event occurred, this is in B.C., in British Columbia, in Canada, southern Canada. And it's an odd-looking design, again in full-grown corn, with a lot of light phenomena, very strange aerial light phenomena reported around the time that it occurred, we found a complex lay inside this one, not just a simple swirling and not a random placement, but layers where you had the crop line in clearly different directions. The first time we'd ever seen that in a corn formation, and we found the expulsion cavities. But this time, they were not just in one node. They were literally all the way down the plant stem. We had, in that particular case, I think they were 10 feet tall, and we had about 8 nodes, every single one of them blown all the way down the plant stem. The amount of energy that it would take to do that is enormously greater than what it would take to do it in oats or barley or wheat. In addition, we started to discover massive twisting and spiraling of some of the stems. This is just one of them in the downed areas again now. Never had seen this before, but it was throughout this particular formation. And we discovered this splitting or breaking very low down the stem. Now, in certain hybrids of corn, there's a condition known as brittle snap. It occurs if the weather has been very specifically wet during a very distinct period during the growth phase. It only happens then, it only happens, as far as the agricultural people know, in these particular hybrids. However, in this case, these were not the hybrids, these were not hybrids involved, not this particular type. There had been none of this weather necessary to cause it. And in addition, as you can see, this is right down near the base of the plant. When brittle snap occurs in these hybrids, it always occurs in the top 2 or 3 nodes. In this case, in Canada, it was throughout the field in every single plant that was down here in the bottom stems, and we tested every single plant in that field. Literally, we went through the entire field, smacked every single plant to see if we could cause this in any of the controls. Not one. Only in the down crop in that formation. Here's a shot showing you close up. It's a nice clean break. Something is mimicking this condition, this brittle snap condition, or causing it to occur in a variety that it's never occurred in before and in a totally different manner than it has before. We don't know what the answer to this is yet, but it's another one of the things that we're working on. Take another case. This one is at Shurr Hill in southern England, where the event included the randomly bound as well as these sporadic little circles. What we were particularly interested in this case were these standing centers within the circles. Close up so you can see how small the circle was. And we also discovered these little flies stuck to the corn, or to the, I think it was the barley. I'm not sure whether it's barley or wheat. There was a lot made about these flies. It was never checked out whether or not this field had been sprayed. Had it been sprayed in the day or so before these bugs arrived, it could easily have killed them. That may be why we have these bugs stuck. We see them every so often in southern England. The crop circle people immediately decided that they had been fried right to the stalk, and that may also be the case, because some of them did seem to be dehydrated completely. But I suspect, frankly, that they were there because the field had been sprayed, and they had come very quickly after it had been sprayed. We need an entomologist to decide that. Here's the sampling diagram showing you the circles that we sampled, and this is the manner in which they were sampled. In this case, the standing center was sampled, as were 4 other points. What we found was that the node length in the standing centers were all elongated over the control group. The controls were standing plants taken outside of this event altogether. So number one, you have an apical node length increase. You also have a seedling weight that was depressed. The seeds in all of those plants, here are the controls again, and in the circle, the weight was less, consistently. when we tried to germinate those plants, however, look what we got. This is an increased growth rate in the formation, and we're talking about standing plants now. These are not flattened, these are the standing centers, giving us this increased growth rate. This fact of the matter is that we do find regularly that standing crop inside the events has been affected so that it grows faster, more vigorously, and more productively than the controls outside in the field. The situation, in other words, is complex. What's going on not only involves quite a variety of plants at different stages of growth with different fertilizers, different pesticides, etc. The phenomenon itself is multi-layered and does a number of different things. It does some of them very consistently, but it does others not quite so consistently. If you've heard much about crop circles, you've heard about bending. It's the least important aspect of the phenomenon, the physical phenomenon. It's the least reliable. Node bending occurs naturally due to phototropism, due to gravitropism. If you knock a plant down and you don't kill it, and it's in a young, vigorously growing time, it will reorient itself to the sun. And it does that by bending at the node. When you find node bending immediately after a crop circle has happened, as in this case, and you find distinct bending like this, it is part of the phenomenon. But unless you know when that crop circle occurred and how soon you're there after it occurred, you can't take that as a reliable sign. It may be, but it may simply be phototropism. In this particular case, and I've seen this in several formations, when the nodes are bent immediately afterwards, then when you first get there, a day or you will see these flaws cutting through the field. And the nodes will be bent to the left and the right. They won't be going up. They'll bend to the left and the right, as they are here, you see? There is another kind of bending. It has nothing to do with the nodes, and that's at the base of the plant. And this is the thing that the people in England talk about the most. This has not been scientifically evaluated. It has been observed for 10 years, and I think there's something to it, but we don't know ultimately that it is reliable. However, when you see it in a plant like this, it's the rapeseed or canola plant. It's a very thick stalk. If you try to bend it, it will snap. When you see this bending here at the base, I think that's probably a good indication that the energies were present in this case rather than manual flattening. Every time that we have tried to flatten canola plants ourselves, they have broken. We have never been able to produce this. So I suspect that when it's at the base of the plant, and particularly when it's a crop like canola, you can rely on that as a fairly good sign. Here's just some more of the plants taken from another. This is bending from another one of those canola formations. One of the control studies that we did, and when you're doing science, you have to do this a lot, is you try to replicate the effects that you're getting to see if you can possibly do it, and if so, how do you do it? In this particular study, the question had been raised as to whether these effects that we're talking about, node elongation, expulsion cavity, germination abnormalities, could they be caused by over-fertilization? This was brought up continually by some of our colleagues, so we had to do an over-fertilization study. We took two strips in southern Maryland and over-fertilized one of them 100%. We then proceeded throughout the summer to make two different sized crop circles in each of the strips simultaneously, and then tested those plants throughout the summer. This is a sampling diagram after the second series has been created. This was series one, and here's series two. We did five or six of these throughout the summer, and then kept testing the plants, not only in the newly made circles, but in the circles that were made some time ago. What we found, here's some of the circles to just show you. This is the recovery of the plants here in the very early stage. See that node bending? That's phototropism. Nothing there, and it was mechanically flattened. It wasn't killed. It began to regrow. We found, though, in examination of these plants, no expulsion cavities at all in any of the formations or in any of the controls. We found no apical node elongation, We did, however, find that at the joint, at the usually the second joint, where the plants began to recover, that you would get node elongation. This is 20 by 21 days, 3 weeks after the formation had been created. You got a 48% increase in the node length at the second node, the penultimate node, where the plant had begun to reorient itself. And we found that it was exactly the same whether it had been over-fertilized or not. We could find no evidence that over-fertilization had anything to do with any of the things that we've been discussing so far. It did not affect node length in the apical node. It did not affect expulsion cavities. It had nothing to do with the germination changes. In fact, over-fertilization simply makes the heads of the plants much heavier. In very severe weather, it's likely to knock it down, which does happen. Did not happen in this study, even though we had a couple of severe storms. But it can happen. When the plants are heavily over-fertilized, the bad weather will then knock them over. And so some of this randomly down crop that you see in the field is, in fact, a natural thing. When the farmers accidentally over-fertilize, they don't tend to over-fertilize easily because it's expensive. It's usually an accident when they've done it. So to sum up this little part, in simple formations like this, a dumbbell up in Saskatchewan, or this one in California last summer, as well as in much more or much less attractive geometric designs like this from Canada. Also in randomly downed areas like this barley field in southern Maryland, you see there are standing centers here in many of these downed areas. We call these dragon's feet. And also in actual geometric designs such as this, or this from South Dakota, this lovely thing. I don't know, has anybody ever seen that one before? It was very little photographed in very end of the season in England about 8 years ago. And in this amazing design, which we're going to talk about later, which was filled with expulsion cavities, or this lovely thing from a place called Whiskey Hill in Oregon, or of course this incredible one from Millville a couple of years ago. Regardless of these designs or lack of designs or their gawkiness or their sophisticatedness, in all of these we have found these changes. So the phenomenon can apparently do simple, gawky, completely nondescript, or like this. It apparently can do any of these. We need to change the slides now. The next, he reminds me. Are there any questions so far? Everybody hanging with me? I'm sorry I can't speak Norwegian. I know everybody here is from English. Are there questions so far? Have I missed something? We have another series of slides, and then I thought we'd take a little break for a minute and let you stretch and got plenty of drink, and then we'll finish up with the third reel. It's a good thing to remember that if someone tells you that all crop circles are mechanically flattened, that number one, this work has been published. This is not just me telling you this. I'm telling you this on behalf of the scientists who did the work, but also on behalf of the scientific journals which have published this work. This is published in peer-reviewed scientific literature. And so you can say to the people who say they're all man-made, okay, how did you do it in standing plants? How did you create those effects? And now let me know what they say. I'd be very interested in those responses. One last case to discuss. This is to give you an idea of just how complex the situation can be. We don't fully understand this case, so I can't pretend that we do. But this is the Julia Fest at Stonehenge in 1996. Very interesting. You look at the formation, and you look at the size. That's Stonehenge. That actually is Stonehenge. So you get some idea of how big this event was. What we discovered here as you can see in these two photos, he's a 13-day seedling, germinated from the seeds that we took out of the plants. What we found was that the down plant samples up here showed a massively increased growth over the standing plant outside. This would be the normal sample and control situation. And we thought, oh, okay, we're going to get a normal case here. Down plants showing this, I mean, the down plants showing an increased growth, and the seedlings outside. Oh, no, wait, I'm sorry. This was the most extreme part of this case. This was the thing we couldn't explain at all. We have the change outside. We'd expect to see the reverse. You see this massively lowered effect. From this case, Levengood got the idea that these energies are definitely not always confined to the downed crop. You'll see what we found inside, why it made it so confusing. This is starting at the edge of the formation. And here we have seedling height. These are the growth rate of the seeds themselves. From just outside the formation, where you had sort of a normal control, you get here, we're 5 feet away from the formation, and you've got a massively reduced growth rate. It's 5 feet outside. Then we go here, and we're 50 feet outside, and we have an increased growth rate again. There's something going on like this outside in that field, an energy delivery that was not straight and simple like it had been so often. We did a number of tests on this formation, and he decided that he thought it was genuine, that this was not due to some sort of strange variety of crop. But we found that the seedlings was on 5 feet outside. And 300 feet. Yeah, and again, here at 300 feet and at 5 feet, you have these markedly reduced growth rates. And yet here, that was immediately after that's just half a foot. This is the normal control. This is what you'd expect. At 5 feet and 300 feet, that's not what we saw. However, in between, we did see what we expected as a control. And a graph that simply shows you overall. There was one other factor in that formation. There was what we call a construction line, a flattened pathway, 4 inches, 5 inches, 6 inches thick, that went in a straight line underneath the entire curving part of the formation. The plants that were on that downed pathway, the samples that we took on that downed pathway, performed differently than down crop that was not on that pathway. Now, we call them construction lines. We don't necessarily mean by man, by humankind. We don't know who does it. But the difference, again, is inexplicable. Why did we have this difference between those samples taken on the pathway and those samples that were not taken on the pathway? And here are the seedlings themselves. Seedlings from the down plants. In one of the circles, okay, that's on the swath. On the swath. And this one, standing plants in the center, showing a massively reduced germination. When you get very complex situations like this that also show you expulsion cavities and other things that you're expecting to see, you realize that you have a great deal more to learn, that these energies can be compartmentalized. It has something to do with the plasma energy, which Levengood has decided is what he thinks is going on, being very, very compartmentalized. And I'll try to explain to you as best I can his idea about how this is happening, but therefore affecting the field very differently depending from formation to formation. The last major finding that was made by Levengood was the discovery of a metallic glaze in a formation at Chur Hill in 1993. The formation looked like this, and the metallic glaze was discovered in those three areas. Now, this formation occurred at the end of the season in August during the Perseids meteor shower. When a meteor shower occurs, you have meteoric dust filtering down to Earth, more so during a meteoric shower. What we thought had happened there was that this energy system, which Levengood believes is an atmospheric plasma, which is descending down towards the Earth, rotating around the magnetic field lines, drew in this atmosphere, this dust, meteoric dust, which is microscopic, then heated it up because of the microwaves being emitted by the spinning plasma, depositing it upon the plant stems. Here, you can see it's embedded in the seed heads here. And it's a photomicrograph showing you it's literally embedded. This was not sprinkled on these plants. It was embedded when it was hot. And all of the evidence clearly shows that. Here we have a melted ridge of this material on some of the dirt. And when we did the EDS, this is two of our different operators on the SEM EDS machine. And what we discovered was that this, again, it's the bottom graph here. So we're not looking at the top, we're looking at the bottom. It's pure iron. There's nothing else there, oxygen and iron. The only thing we could think of was that this meteoritic dust had become involved in the plasma energy system, heated up by the microwaves that are being emitted, becomes molten, and then it's hitting the ground in the molten hot state, causing what we discovered on the ground. Another... Can you see the bubble? I can't see it where I am as well. Another indication, it's literally a bubble of hematite. It's getting the heat again. Another thing was discovered in that particular event were multiple particles like this. That's maybe, what would you say, 10 microns, maybe 50 microns in diameter? Very pure iron again. We never knew before this event to look for this, but because of this event, we began sampling soils. And what we discovered, much to our surprise, was that perhaps 80% of them, we would find these tiny little spheres of very pure iron. But here's a case in Canada, two simple circles of short distance away from each other. And this is the sampling diagram showing you how we did this. It's interesting that the sampler field guy in this case did just a northern access because what we found were these tiny little particles, again, very pure iron, spherical. The only way they can be a sphere is if they're falling in a molten state through the air. That's the way we used to make lead shot. You'd heat it up and dump it off a tower, and what does it do? It forms a ball. These do not occur in the environment normally. They have to have been hot and falling through the air to form these spheres, and they're magnetized. And we found those in these formations and distributed again in a relatively linear fashion along the northern axis. This suggests that there's some sort of interaction between this energy system and the Earth's magnetic field. This is not the tightest correlation you'll ever get, but there have been some that have been right on the money. Another case in Canada also, I don't have an aerial, but here's some of the interior shots, produced something very tight. This is part of a formation. This is the part we're looking at. We have a down center, a standing ring, and a down outer ring. And these are the sampling lines in this case. These are the little particles that we found. And look at that for correlation. This is the center of the circle. That's the edge. That could not happen by accident. That's where, remember, you're talking 10, 15, 20 micron diameter little spheres. You can't even see them. And yet, the sampling, which is done absolutely according to a protocol, nobody's looking for anything. We're taking a certain amount of surface soil at each one of these sampling locations. And this is the result. This indicates, we think, a rotating delivery system, an aerial rotating delivery system. Another case in New York, the formation itself underneath, and these are the sampling, the fashion in which these were sampled. This one, we found these particles not only inside, but outside the formation, again spread a considerable distance outside and in a linear fashion. Here are the inside depositions, the material deposited in this case, the greatest amount at the center, reducing to the edge. In the case we just looked at, it was the greatest amount at the edge and the least in the center. It reverses itself. But again, it's linear. And this is, let's circle two. Darn it. No, I'm sorry, I screwed that up. This is outside both of those circles. These are, this is in the standing crop, and this is the edge going out, way out into the field. That's the very edge of the crop circle going out to the ends. However, what we find is that a much less elegant looking situation like this often shows much more dramatic changes. This happens to be another one in England, but we often see this sort of a lay where it's very fluffy and undulating and not flat to the ground, where the changes can be quite severe. Often you see this sort of a pattern is considered to be indicative of the real phenomenon. And I love this particular photograph because you can see this S-shaped, this spiraling lay. This one was at Telegraph Hill in England and back in 1995. And had all of the earmarks, and at the very end of the lecture there's something I want to tell you about that particular formation. But you do see this sort of spiral inside the lay of the crop often. We have seen, and are seeing with increasing frequency, these splits, or cuts, or burns, or whatever they are. We're seeing them in almost every country now. I was in Germany a few years ago, and there's a beautiful double spiral that we had found and decided to sample. Before we could get there the next morning, the entire field had gone down, covering the spiral, so we had to really hunt to find it. And these edges everywhere, I'm seeing them now all the time, not just in wheat, oats, and barley, but in corn and other things. I don't know what it means, it's just, it's turning up all the time. It does not seem to be a mold. There is an opportunistic mold known as Euthalago, which can cause a very darkening of the stem. In the cases where we've tested this, it has not been Euthalago. It's more likely that it's actual burning, charring. We know that crop circles often seem to occur around electrical pylons. These are some cases from Germany. Here's one of these cross-country pylons, and a number of formations clustered around it. They do frequently occur directly underneath these pylons, and we don't yet know whether that's important, but in these, you can see again the expulsion cavities that were found in these formations. They also occur very close to houses. This particular formation is in Ohio, in one of the few lots there that didn't have a house on it. The people who slept in this bedroom the night this occurred heard, saw, felt nothing. It was simply there the next morning. And they will cross boundaries. A lot of people don't seem to know this. These are two different fields. The colors are not very good. But this formation continues into the second field. This is a shot from Poland a couple of years ago. And one that I think many people have seen. But in this case, the formation circled the roadway. This was the first formation. And then sometime later, this formation occurred. And at an even later date, that circle in the very top was added. I had a very strange experience in that particular formation. Furthermore, once a crop circle has occurred, we need more people, because what we need to be doing is going back every year to exactly the same location, because this sort of thing happens. And you can't, unfortunately, the way the slide is that there is a small formation up here that you can't see. This formation didn't do anything. That's the small one. There you go. Where that formation had been, this is what happened the next year. The guy plowed it and planted it, did everything normally. Nothing would grow. This often happens for several years after a formation has occurred. Sometimes you see this. This is in the spring of the following year. And where the formation with the down crop had been, you have the design appearing again all by itself, as if by magic. And in a formation, this particular one, at Barbary Castle, quite an elegant event with lots of interesting things going on, the crop that was planted the subsequent year and came up, here we have the formation plants, and here we have the controls. In other words, all the plants within the old formation grew about 2 feet taller than the plants in the rest of the field. Something had affected those soils permanently, or semi-permanently, so that the new crop was affected. planks and boards will not do that. Crop circles, of course, occur in many, many different mediums. This is the canola plant when it's in flower. Here we have it in corn. They occur even in flowers. This is a field of flowers in Germany. Here's the formation, and this is what it looked like on the ground. In this case, simply walking in that field left imprints. There was no way that you could go in that field without crushing the flowers, and yet the flowers in the formation were completely untouched. The people who took these photographs said that every single place where they walked left a clear mark, a clear footprint. So, now we get to the theory. Now, this is Levengood's explanation, or his best concept effort so far, of what it is that's going on. These are solar flares taken recently from one of the observatories. That's like the picture. He's talking about plasma, the so-called fourth state of matter. And plasma is essentially electrified air. When plasma forms these, a plasma system that you'd be familiar with is, say, a lightning strike. That's a discharge of a very high energy plasma. The northern lights are another plasma with a very low energy plasma. What Levengood is suggesting is that this plasma, the upper atmosphere being entirely plasma, and here is the Earth, by the way, this is a sun spot, and the Earth, to give you some idea of the magnitude of these events. He thinks that these plasma balls form in the upper atmosphere and are producing something that is either occurs so seldom and hasn't been recognized yet, or is it simply been overlooked. Because the upper atmosphere is almost entirely plasma, and here are the northern lights, and because they spiral, they tend to spiral around the Earth's magnetic field lines. When they do that, they're emitting microwaves. They're also involved, they have very strong magnetic fields involved with them, and they emit electrical pulses. Now remember, he's found in the plants evidence of exposure to microwaves, evidence of unusual electrical pulses, and clear evidence in the soils of very strong magnetic fields. These are all attributes of plasmas. Some years ago, sprites were first identified. Pilots had been seeing them at about 6, 7, 8 miles above the Earth's atmosphere, and the science community denied their existence because they had never seen one. A guy at the University of Colorado, about 8 years ago now, actually photographed one. Now they have a name, and the pilots are exonerated. Yes, they're a sprite. This is a plasma discharge that was never known until 8 years ago. Just last year, this is another type of plasma discharge known as a blue jet. Now, never discovered until 2003. What Levengood is saying is that it may be that there is an atmospheric plasma system completely unknown so far that is originating, he believes, in the ionosphere, triggered by what he doesn't know. He has no explanation for that so far. But once triggered, that spirals around magnetic field lines coming into the Earth, emitting microwaves, giving off strong magnetic fields, pulling in meteoric dust, etc., and then impacting the Earth's surface. And if you imagine a beach ball, a clear plastic beach ball, and imagine inside it golf balls, tennis balls, soccer balls, whatever, baseballs, all different sized balls, each one of which is a plasma, each one of which is interacting with all of the others, and then you picture that three-dimensional object impacting a two-dimensional crop surface, you begin to get the idea of how designs could occur, because you have a three-dimensional object impacting a flat surface, and what's inside the three-dimensional object is constantly moving. It's constantly in a different state. This could conceivably, and in his mind, create the crop circles. I am not telling you that's what's happening. I'm trying to explain what he says because a lot of his work is based, I mean, he's basing this theory on his work. The data that he has gathered fits very nicely with this idea. Whether it turns out to be the final answer or not, I don't know. But it does fit the data that exists better than anything anybody else has suggested. Here we just have an illustration of the Northern Lights showing you how they spiral. And in a laboratory-generated plasma, again, we have the spiraling motion. One interesting point is that a large majority of crop circle designs fit with these schematics. A man in Japan some years ago, a plasma physicist, is one of the, in fact, I think the only plasma physicist who has even looked at this problem, generates plasmas in the lab and then discharges them, allows them to impact surfaces that are covered with dust or dirt or whatever. These are the patterns that form spontaneously, regularly. Nature produces this pattern all by itself all the time. We don't understand exactly why, but we know it happens. These are the most frequently generated patterns by laboratory-created plasmas. It's not hard to produce these at all, and it can produce much more complicated designs. When you have interacting plasmas, as in this case in Maryland, in Levengood's opinion, you often see this ridge of crops right down through the middle of these circles. His notion is that you have these plasmas generating, operating in different directions, creating this ridge. And to him, this is very good evidence that in this case there were two interacting plasmas, not one, but three or five, but two, creating this ridge and the design in the field. Now, if in fact it is a plasma, or maybe it's not a plasma, but if in fact it has any of the attributes that he says it does, the next question was, well, why do they occur in some places rather than others? The first thing that we did was look at southern England, and we discovered, of course, that there's a chalk aquifer. Chalk is the most porous rock, and as such, water, as it percolates down through the chalk over the summer, sets up an electrical charge. We've measured that electrical charge and in fact discovered that over the summer this ground electrical charge increases. Not greatly, but it does increase significantly. This is one of the white horses in southern England showing you the chalk is just underneath the grass. You scrape away the grass and this is exactly what you'll find. And you have this rock all over this area of southern England. And as it turns out, we have limestone underneath a great number of the others. Limestone is the next most porous rock. The diagram showing you the number of crop circles that occur in any given year over chalk or greensand in southern England, and the majority of them do. Another thing that we found, we went to the Water Bureau, the Water Statistics Bureau in Wiltshire, and found that they had begun to pump the aquifer in southern England. And in some years, they had pumped it very, very low. Interestingly enough, when the aquifer was at its lowest, meaning the surface water had to travel farther to get down to it, and therefore the ground electrical charge was at its greatest, those were the years when we had the most crop circles, at least up to the point where this graph goes. The greatest numbers had occurred when this water table was at its lowest, and the ground electrical charge was at its greatest. If, in fact, a plasma is involved, the ground electrical charge could be an attractor to that plasma, drawing it down in those particular locations. Finally, the design element. There's another aspect to the design element. Levengood, back in 1966, had done an experiment on something known as vortex instability. It's one of the aspects that has something to do with the creation of design in nature. As far as I can understand it, no one knows exactly why this works, why it happens. They simply know that it does. He published his paper on this in Nature in 1966. Took a beaker, this is a very simple experiment, a beaker of water, into which he introduced a slightly colored, slightly more dense solution. It's colored simply so you can see it. The idea is you put this drop in without disturbing the water at all, And then you simply photograph what happens as it descends through the beaker. And here's a series of shots showing you how that particular drop evolves. Now, every time you do this experiment, it produces something different, every single time. But this particular one is one strip of the photograph. And I wanted to show you some of the crop circles next to some of the photographs of what happened in that beaker. Look at that again. See all these little... And this is an actual crop circle. There were several of them in that year that had this same sort of aspect. In addition, you have other clear and obvious patterns caused in water. Air is a medium much like water. Well, this spiral, of course, you've seen that over and over and over again in crop circles. This in no way stretches the possibilities of a plasma, if in fact the plasma is what's causing this. If we've got multiple interacting, thermodynamically unstable, chaotic, in other words, plasmas, this organizing principle is typical in nature. I mean, you look at seashells. It's all over the place. It's nothing uncommon. It doesn't require ETs to make a design like that. Here we have a sunflower head, and there have been multiple crop formations that follow these exact design elements. Oh, I hit that one upside down, sorry. And then I did put in a few diagrams here. These are diagrams of particles, electrons, usually around magnetic fields, showing you, you can't see them, so we've diagrammed them to show you how they behave, how they act. This is, in fact, if I remember correctly, it's electrons around a magnetic field and simply how it behaves. Well, haven't we seen crop circles that have that same sort of design to it? The point seems to be that this vortex instability, these design elements, their size invariant, doesn't make any difference how big the event is. The same principles seem to be guiding it regardless. It can be microscopic or it can be macroscopic. And when you think a little bit about all the designs you see every day, you don't think about it when you look at a flower, how intricate that design is. But in fact, it is. And ETs didn't do it. Nature did it. Here we have another design from the Magneto textbooks, and the crop circle looks exactly like it. Exactly in that case. And this, which looks so much like the East Median Crescent. Okay. We say it's time to take a rest, and then we'll come back with the SRD study in my eyewitness account, if you guys aren't bored to death. We've done most recently some of our most recent work, then the eyewitness account, and some of these wild photos. I think it's very interesting. Some people do not really enjoy the science part, and I make them wait for the pictures. Because I'm insistent that they should hear the science first. This is a crop circle that occurred in Logan, Utah, to the middle of the United States, I think it was 1996. And it was at that formation that this study was instigated. A geologist who lived in Utah, and I did not know at the time, went to this formation because it was near her house, and her field was clay mineralogy, and she had just written a dissertation on the effects of heat on very specific clay minerals in soil. Nothing to do with copper, but with clay. These particular clays are calcite, smectite. They respond to heat, and this was what her work had been about. Now, she has read Levengood's papers. Oh, by the way, before I go any farther, these papers are available on our website. They're there in their entirety. You can print them right out on the website. You can also go to the journals and get them if you like, but you don't have to. The website is www.bltresearch.com. So it's bltresearch.com. And there are many other things there too, but the formal papers are there if you want them. At any rate, she decided, having read Levengood's papers, that if he was correct, that heat was involved, there ought to be some effect on the clay minerals. And since she knew something about them, she decided to take some samples and see what she could find. I want you to notice also this hole that was found in the center of that circle and the circle. It's basically a triangle. And what's important about it is that it surfaces later on in this study. Holes in crop circles does not always mean that somebody stuck something in the middle and then made it, apparently. Because this formation showed all the basic changes and some other interesting things too. This is the lay of the crop inside that formation. The Brits don't like this. This is a man-made because it's not neat and tidy. Get that out of your head. That's not true. This lay turned out to be several layers. The top layer was quite chaotic like this. Underneath there were neater layers, and you'll see that in the study formation in just a minute. Just another shot to show you how wild that crop was. It was lying radially out from the center to the edge in a very chaotic manner. This is the sampling diagram showing you right through the formation. And here are, again, the kind of results that we found. Distinct elongation in the apical nodes, the top node that needs the seed head. And furthermore, in the two different sides, in that middle circle, the northern radius gave us a definite increase in node length at exactly the same point that we found on the southern. So you draw a diameter right through that circle, which we did. And along the northern end, from the center out, there's this massive increase in node length at exactly the same location where we found it on the southern end. But clearly, the energy that was being emitted was slightly different because you have such a huge increase along the northern radius as compared to the southern. Levengood is trying to illustrate with some of these diagrams that there are different energies at work. It is not just microwave radiation, it is other things going on also. Here are the expulsion cavities that in fact did occur in that formation. And here is a lovely little light bulb. One of the things that was unusual about this formation was that some local visitors who had never seen a crop circle visited this about 3-4 weeks after it formed. There was nobody in the field when they arrived at dusk. And when they got there, they saw loads of these little light bulbs in the field. They thought that was normal. They had heard about crop circles. They heard about strange lights. They figured that this was completely normal. And so they went into the field and played with the lights. They chased them. And the lights stayed, according to Dave Rosenfeld, who did this, about 3 feet in front of him. If he would turn around and walk away, they'd come right behind him, staying about 3 feet away. And he and his girlfriend played for about an hour with these. He was then getting a little bored. He wanted them to come closer, and so he decided to play a game. And he said out loud, "Well, I'm bored, and I'm leaving." He took his girlfriend's hand and started to walk down as if he was really leaving. And then swung around very quickly, and there was a light bulb right next to his shoulder. It apparently thought he was leaving. Well, he went to the car and got his camera, and he did get this shot. It's the only photograph he got, because he'd left his camera in the truck earlier. But these light bulbs, he's the only person that I know of who has seen these lights and interacted with them. Of course, in this case, knowing nothing about what they were. But all the other cases have been people who've seen them, or more commonly, people photograph crop circles and find these things on their film, but never see them. In this case, he actually plays with them. Well, this is Diane Conrad, the geologist, who did the original work. And what she did was take some samples. There's her control and samples from the crop circle. And then she submitted, first of all, you have to extract the clays out of these soils. It was a fairly tedious process, but she did that. And then once they were extracted, you mount them on a slide and submit them to the X-ray diffraction machine. The way the X-rays bounce off the sample gives you these graphs. And I don't know exactly how they know, but each one of these peaks represents a separate element in the sample. This peak is in fact the clay, these illite smectite, these particular clays that we were looking at. As the peak narrows, the crystalline structure has increased. So when you see, as in the control here, a fairly wide distance between the two sides of that peak, it means the sample is not well crystallized. Down here, you have a much better crystallization because the peak is tighter. Now, this is an automated procedure. The machines are calibrated, and it's done by people who, a mineralogist who has the expertise, but there's no way to fudge it. Once you've extracted the clays, they're simply mounted and run through the X-ray diffraction machine. It's very expensive. You could never do this on every crop circle because this study cost about $80,000, $90,000. Obviously, we can't be doing that on every crop circle. In picking, once she had done this and found this result, she told me about it, and I thought, you know, I would very much like to do a formal study. I tried for a couple of years to raise the money, and finally, Lawrence Rockefeller, who just has recently died, called me to New York because he had heard about our work, and he was very interested in a number of these things, and he asked me, believe it or not, to submit a proposal, which of course I did immediately. I submitted several. It's very seldom you get offered, you know, money to do this sort of work. And he did fund the study, which is why we were able to do it. We looked at a number of different crop circles, you know, trying to find a formation which represented what we knew so far. We were looking for a formation that had elongated nose, ones that had expulsion cavities, ones that had the presence of the magnetic particles, and some of the germination abnormalities. We looked at this formation first, and you can't see the top of it, but there are three circles there, lined up. There you go. This one was in Saskatchewan, and it looked like a good candidate, but the problem was that the farmer in that case had cut a large part of the field, and we couldn't get the proper control, so we couldn't use that one. This is Robert Vanderbroek in Holland, and this particular formation, actually, I think this is the one that occurred on Good Friday a couple of years ago, and we thought we had a wonderful one from him that we had sampled, but the material in that case, the soils, were too rich. The soils in Holland are very good, at least this particular farmer's field, and to extract the clays would have cost us about $60,000. That was obviously not cost effective, so we had to pass that particular circle. Then we looked at one in Montana, this formation here, which had been sampled properly. It did have the expulsion cavities, it did have all the changes, but the field workers in this case didn't follow the instructions and had not gotten the controls properly. So every one of these cases had to be discarded because they didn't meet the criteria. What we ended up with was this formation in Edmonton, Canada. We don't have an aerial, but this is a diagram showing you exactly what it looked like. A seven circle event in a field of barley. And that's interesting because it turns out that the original formation in Utah wasn't barley. Well, so is this one. And we had this very chaotic lay, just like we had had at Logan, Utah. This is one end of that formation. And here's the other end of it. Discovered by the farmer as he was preparing to harvest the field, and thank God he stopped and left the rest of the field untouched until we could finish the work that we had to do. A close-up to show you again the lay. This is the top layer, totally chaotic and, you know, messy looking. But a diagram clearly shows you what was going on underneath. In the very bottom layer, we had this very thin 6 to 8 inch wide ring around each of the circles, the very outside edge. On top of that, there was a radial lay that went from the center, covering that lower, that underneath the ring. And then on top of that, you had the utterly chaotic stuff. So there are basically three layers, which is exactly what we had seen at Logan, Utah. Here we have in the field elongated nodes. And I photographed them in the field so people believe that it actually was in the field. In addition, very curiously, we found this triangular-shaped hole. In both cases, the Logan, Utah, and in this one, that hole was about 2 feet deep, and the same shape, the same size. In this one, we found a seed head embedded head down, and this was bearded barley, and the beards were intact. The beards have a long, skinny spike on either side of the seed head. They break very easily. How in the world the thing went in that hole head down, we can't imagine, but we found it there. Now, this is one of the sampling diagrams. We sampled three of these circles. This is the big center circle, and all of these diameters were sampled. Here's a control line, and another control line, and a third. Here's the diagram for the smaller circles, and the third one. Very unfortunately, that third circle, there was thistle in this field, massive infestation of Canadian thistle, and their legs were getting chewed up because it was so prickly, and their hands, and it was cold, it was getting all nearly winter by the time they were doing this, and they didn't finish the last crossbar here. If they had, our data would have been stronger than it is. However, it's strong enough, so I shouldn't complain. And here's another control line. Again, Levin Good did his normal standard work. There were several scientists involved in this case, Levin Good being the only one who knew anything about crop circles or had had any association with crop circles previously. What he found was that there was node length increase, just like we have seen hundreds of times before. The controls here on your left, 109% increase in the small circle. This is something we find consistently. The smaller the circle in a multi-circle event, the greater the changes will be. They tend to be much more intense in the smaller events. And here we have the medium-sized circle at 70% increase, and the big center circle with a 65% increase. That's over the controls. All of them very statistically. Furthermore, when he looked at the increase in the nodes along each of the radii, each section of the diameters, in that large circle, what you find, here are the controls again on the left, you have about the same increase if you add up all of the changes in one radii. About the same. What he's trying to show you here, which we'll see in just a minute, is the magnetic particle concentration does not go along evenly like that at all. Here we have some of the magnetic material that was found in that particular formation, and this is how it was distributed along the radii. Nowhere near the evenness. What Levin is illustrating there is that there are different energies at work. This is not a single energy. This is a complex energy mechanism that's causing these various effects. We only understand a little bit about some of them. I mean, in her digital screen, the formation itself was there. She could see it, but it was becoming black and white. By the time she was down at 250 feet, it was totally black and white. The plane would go back up, the color would come. She'd go back down, the color would disappear. She did this several times. Meanwhile, she's shooting with the film. This is what came back with the film. And what you see, I think I've got a closer up here. This, you can very faintly see, in the original anyhow, the design, very, very faintly. We don't lose the color, we lose the image altogether on the film. This is not a problem with the film. We've had the film tested. This was not a problem with the development. And the anomalies are entirely contained within the frame. This is something, some energy has affected the film in this case. And at this point, it was some 200 to 500 feet up above the formation. That's Robert. This is Robert a couple of years ago. I go there almost every summer and have these wild experiences which make me really scratch my head. I think it was in 2001, he and I, we've been doing magnetometer studies, electromagnetometer and geomagnetometer studies with Dr. William Roll. For those of you who know Roll, he's a parapsychologist in the United States, and he's very interested in how this crop circle phenomenon might relate to his interest, which is electromagnetic you know, weirdnesses in the environment. And so he gave me all this equipment, and I went and spent day after day after day lugging this stuff out into the fields. It was hot as it could be. We have to climb over barbed wire fences and crawl up dikes. I hated the whole time. But we found nothing. We did the work. We found absolutely no aberrations at all. We would go to the crop circles, no differences. I mapped his entire house. I mapped his backyard. I mapped the field out behind his house. Nothing that would explain why these strange things are constantly going on in his environment. At least nothing electromagnetic. This is the back of his house. I'm staying there in the door. And this is the bedroom where I was staying. This is Robert's bedroom. Usually moves out when I come and I get it, because it's the nicest bedroom in the house. But from the back here, you look straight out over a garden and then to a field beyond. This is the kitchen, and it's important that you notice that. Kitchen and the bedroom. This is the view from the bedroom when I arrived after a year. And, you know, this is their garden, and they sit in a lovely medicine wheel. And then behind is these farm fields, and each year it's in some different crop. I always now, the very first thing I do, go up there and take a couple of pictures because something's going to happen, and I want to document it before it happens. So this is the first day of arrival. In the middle of the night, sometime later, this was at the end of 2.5 weeks into this, Robert had wanted to go out in the fields, not these, but other fields, to take photographs because he loves to do it with a digital camera. We've got all these weird things. And I was so angry, I was tired and hot and disgusted, actually. And I said, you know, I'm sick and tired of this phenomenon. Why is it so hard to study? Why is this so difficult? I'm going to bed. The hell of it, essentially. I went upstairs into that bedroom, got into my nightgown, floor-to-ceiling glass doors wide open because it was so hot. There was a very thin, gauzy curtain through which you can see that I had pulled while I'd gotten into my nightgown. I was in the bed reading, and I heard the cattle in the barn down the road begin to bellow. Now, I've been there many, many years. I didn't even know there were cattle down there. They have never done this before. I knew from the farmers that I talked to all the time that this bellowing indicated that something was happening. And I thought I should get up and go and stand in those windows, that I would see the whole thing. But for some reason, I don't know why I didn't. I stayed in the bed. The cattle became quiet, a few minutes elapsed, and then they started again. And this second time, they bellowed, clearly distressed. And I knew something was getting ready to happen. I knew it. I was quite sure. And for some reason, I stayed in the bed. Now, I'm looking straight out these doors to this view, and what I then saw were tubes, not exactly like this, but that's the best Andreas could do in illustrating it. The tubes were 1.5 feet, 2 feet in diameter. They came crashing down like a train coming at your head. I have never experienced such force in my life, even though it wasn't coming at me. It was coming straight down into that field. It lit up the field like daytime, which there's no way we can illustrate this and show you the columns, but that whole field was lit up. I could see all the way across the field. And the room that I was in lit up like I was on Broadway, like there were spotlights on it. My immediate reaction was simply like, oh my, you know, Lord, what is this? I was afraid. I mean, it was very sudden, very forceful, and brilliant. It only lasted for a second or so, and then it was gone. There was no noise. There was no smell. There were no electromagnetic responses, you know, on my skin. And it was almost like it hadn't happened. And I was, did I see that or not? And before I could even question it, right, another one came shooting down. In exactly the same place, as far as I could tell, looked the same size, absolutely straight, no variation in it at all. It again lit everything up outside and inside, and then disappeared. It was gone. Well, by now I'm thinking, God, I hope Robert, whom I had left down in the kitchen, was watching the same thing, because you don't want to see something like this by yourself. And I started to get out of bed. Before I could get out of bed, a third column had come down exactly the same. And by now I'm yelling, Robert, Robert. Well, he's halfway up the stairs because he's scared to death. And he's yelling, Nancy, Nancy. We went immediately to the windows and looked up. See, these are our diagrams, by the way. I had him do this afterwards. This is his diagram of what he saw from the kitchen. This is my diagram of what I saw from the bedroom. Very interesting that neither one of us talked about the spiraling motion that we both observed. He drew it, and so did I. So when we were telling each other about it, we didn't mention this. A couple of other things we didn't mention either. But this is him watching from the kitchen, and this is me from upstairs. And we went immediately outside. We looked upstairs up first. There was nothing in the sky as far as I could see. There was normal sky. And we went to the back fence. He has his fence at the end of his garden. And I had a flashlight, and I'd shown it over. And we saw, you know, this discolored area. It was quite clear there was something there in the field. This was string beans. Crop circle, we'd never had a crop circle in string beans before. I don't think there's been one since. But that field was in string beans, and the crop circle was very definitely in the beans. Now I'm back on the balcony here showing you it. The next morning, I didn't have to get out of bed to see that crop circle. All I had to do was lift my head. Now I had just said, why is this so hard to study? Why do I have to work like this? And, I mean, I don't have to get out of bed the next morning. There it is. So I think it tells you, think of carefully about what you wish for, because I didn't even know I was wishing for anything.
I think the best thing is the medicine, though.
Yes. But there it is. Now, it wasn't a simple circle. It actually, this is what it looked like. It was an ellipse with this T-shaped thing on the end of it. Now, some people have said, of course, my name is Paul, but now that's going a bit far for me. I mean, this is what it looks like, but it's a bit much to think that the T is for Talbot. This shape, of course, has been seen before. The lay of the crop was a very straightforward, simple lay. The edges were very clean. This is, I'll show you close up what it looked like in the field. This path goes off in this direction. Now, here you can see the lay of the crop all this way and then all that, or vice versa. Going this way. And you see the beans? I love string beans, so after we'd done the investigation, I took hold of the beans and cooked them. He wouldn't touch them. I ate them for dinner, he would not touch them. He asked me if I glow in the dark, and I don't. This is the pathway. One row, only one row wide, heading out into the field. Okay, so that night, as soon as it was dark, this is a friend of Robert's, Robert behind, and then his friend. We went into this because one of the things we know is that if you go into crop circles when they're new and take pictures, you're going to get a lot of weird lights. Robert loves the weird lights. So we went into this thing with our cameras and got a whole, I mean, film after film. I got rolls of it. Most of them, these dense little orbs or these multifaceted ones. It was not wet. We were extremely careful about taking these pictures as far as dust. No aggravation of the soil. I was very careful about that because tiny little particles of dust in front of the lens, again, might be the cause. Now I'm told, no, it's bugs. There weren't any bugs. I guarantee you there were no bugs there that night. But the skeptics will have their say, you know. And here's another one of these objects, which I now have, remember, I just got this photograph of it in broad daylight. And I haven't had time to make a slide, but I can't wait to do it and put it up here so people can see that you can photograph them in daytime. And this is just to show you, this is the circle and there's the bedroom. And how close that was. To finish, I just wanted to remark about this formation at Telegraph Hill. This is the formation as it appeared originally. Sometime later, this Om sign appeared in the field. I think it was a good week and a half later. I was not in England that summer, but I got these photographs and was intrigued. I live right across the street from Harvard University, and there's a marvelous Department of Linguistics there. So I took a photograph of that, the sign itself. That's looking down the hill. And I took it to the Department of Linguistics. They referred me to a professor of Sanskrit in India, and I got in touch with him, asked him to examine that sign and give me whatever information he could about it. I mean, I didn't present it as the Sanskrit for Om. I simply asked him if he recognized it and what he could tell me. What he told me was that it was the Sanskrit for Om, and it was the way it was written in one tiny little village in southern India some 800 years previously. Now, all I know is what he said. He's a scholar. That's what he said. It intrigued me from the minute I saw it, but it suggests to me something marvelous, something really remarkable. I don't think crop circles are likely to be simply an act of nature, a spontaneous act of nature, as we understand it. I have a feeling that there's a consciousness involved, and it may be a very profound one. Thank you for coming. Appreciate it very much. If you all have questions, if there are things I can answer, I'm happy to do it. What did most of you think crop circles were all about? Are there lots of different opinions? Are there people here who are certain it's, they're all man-made?
Are any links between crop circles and UFOs? Has there been observed any
The best thing to know about UFOs is a very photographic line in the crop circles, like a very And in my work, where I talk to the landowners, the farmers, and the ranchers, I am told consistently, at least 50%, maybe 60% of the time, I haven't done the analysis, that they have seen either immediately before the crop circle was found, or at some time in the 5, 10, 15, even 20-year past, that they have had direct experience of a UFO. I think that's very interesting. Not necessarily that a UFO caused that crop circle, but there does seem to be more than a casual relationship between the people who own the property upon which the crop circles occur and the UFO phenomenon.
There's a similarity because both the UFOs and the crop circles affect electrical equipment, which is working.
Correct.
And also, there's also similarity between animals, the ancient animals. Also,
I know. And in fact, we don't publicize it very much because the whole BLT effort is aimed at helping the non-involved public to be aware there's a real phenomenon. That's our primary effort. And therefore, we don't tell them some things because they can't handle it. It's too much. But the fact of the matter is that we have sampled a number of UFO trace cases. This is where a UFO has landed or has hovered. And we have worked on the plants and soils at those events, and we find almost identical changes in the plants and soils. Now, to me, that doesn't mean that UFOs create crop circles. What it means is that the energies involved are, at least some of them, the same, clearly, obviously. But it doesn't mean necessarily that UFOs, whatever in the hell they are, make crop circles. In fact, they may be coming around because they're as curious as we are. I don't think you can jump to that conclusion. It may end up being so, but we can't prove it now.
I was wondering, has there been any more research about how fire is affected within crop
circles? Interesting. You hear a lot of reports out of England every summer that are very casually made, not backed up with any serious work. One of those reports that I've always wanted to follow up on was this notion that if you took time stopwatches into crop circles and left one in the control location, took others in, and then did the work, you have to actually do something here. You have to write down things and have people watching and all that. They've indicated that there was some slight difference, but they only did it in one or two formations, and they didn't have anybody witnesses, and they didn't document it. But that's a very... People say they think they can't do anything. Anybody here, if you decided to do that experiment, could do it. and you could produce some data that would be useful. You decide you're going to visit 5, 10, 15 circles. You get 2 or 3 stopwatches, you get 1 friend, you make sure you leave one in a clear control area where you've got somebody watching it the entire time. You take the other one or 2 in, they're all synchronized, you videotape it when you come out, and you write down, you know, what the differences are. You do that on 15, 20 crop circles, and you get a result. You've started to add information to what is known. There are many, many things that absolutely ordinary people with no particular knowledge, looking up the geological data, for instance, about where crop circles occur, you can go and find in every county the substrata. Is it limestone? Is it chalk? You know, what is it? Is it granite? Begins to build up the data. All you have to do is be curious, and then a little discipline, you know, in the doing of it. And it can add to what everybody knows. That's all science is. Most of what we've done is very simple. Up until this XRD study, there was nothing massively sophisticated. I mean, we're counting notes, for heaven's sake. We're measuring notes. Anybody could have done that. And I encourage people who are curious about this to think of experiments that they could run and think of ways to do controls and then document everything meticulously, because you might very well open up a whole new piece of information, you know, about crop circles.
Do you have any study on if it's the crop cycles appear in the roads or houses?
No one's done the data. The majority of them, of course, occur out in the middle fields, but a definite percentage go across hedgerows, around roads like that, or are budding, you know, cut off by roads, and a lot of them occur very close to houses. You don't see it in the picture because the photographer is going for, the photographer is trying to get something that you'll want to buy, and what you want to buy is the crop circle, not the houses. But in fact, a definite percentage of them occur close too. Now, until you test all of these, you don't know which ones are real and which ones aren't. And the only way to know if your idea is, well, if they're close to a house, kids made it, would be to test them all.
I believe then, I'm thinking of if something that someone's trying to tell us something, it would be...
If it's a communication, it's not very good. Because the only kind of way it would be good, if the communication is simply to make you ask questions and think, well, then it's good. But if they're trying to communicate something specific, I'd say they're not too smart, because I don't get it. I don't get specifically what I'm supposed to be understanding here. All I get from them is, the crop circles I mean, is a thing of wonder, a thing that makes me think and want to know more. I mean, a lot of people are sure this is a direct communication. Well, I don't understand the language. I mean, I don't understand it. And it seems to me that if I were trying to communicate with you, and I were real serious about it, I'd learn Norwegian to make sure you understood. So I don't think it's that kind of a thing. It may be, though, if the consciousness, if there is a consciousness involved, which I suspect there is, then... it may be simply to rattle your cage, get you thinking, make you consider ideas that you don't normally consider.
They show you how to deal with energy.
They haven't shown us that yet. I'd like it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, about the history of the crop circle, we told that in the Indians, 800 years ago, there was also... So it has been a long time.
That's a good point. Crop circles are not a modern phenomenon. We've only heard of this current flap since, the late 60s. But, in fact, there is clear documentation in 1880 in Nature magazine, a very clear description by an English scientist of the time of crop circles on his property, and an even clearer description in 1668, in a book called A History of Staffordshire, written by a different British scientist who had a country estate in the southern section of England. And he not only describes them, he draws pictures. And we have spirals and squares and circles and ring circles and undulating serpent-like, you know, crop circles. And he did a number of experiments And he discovered, or felt that he had discovered, that the soil inside these circles was drier than the surrounding control areas. But it appears that they are not, and we know, we have anecdotal reports constantly from the early 1900s in several countries, in Canada, in the U.S., in England, and a few photographs now are beginning to surface that were taken in the very beginning of photography. So it's apparently not a brand new thing. And it's the complexity is not new either. They weren't just simple circles back then. So it's a recurring theme. And then you look at the randomly down stuff and think, well, what's that? Is that a kid learning how to do this? And he hasn't got it right yet? I mean, I go back and forth. I can see that it's quite possible that nature by itself, for some reason we don't understand, is generating these things. And it could be a spontaneous generation for some reason we don't understand yet. And then some of these other experiences that I've had, and I've had many of them now, where I think, my God, what are the chances of a crop circle happening where I don't have to get on a bed right after I've said this thing? What are the chances of that? It must be astronomical. And several things like that have happened, so I don't know.
Had a formation some years ago in an alien head.
Are you talking about the one at Joe Bolton? He's on the Crabwood.
Well, yeah, I don't know, but I've seen some photos. Was that a real formation?
If you're speaking of the one at Crabwood,
yeah.
There were no node elongations observed, no expulsion cavities, the magnetic drag was not performed, so we don't know about that. I was told that the pathways were 2 inches wide. That's not true. The heads of the crop, when it gets old, they bend over. The tops of those pathways were about 2 inches. The bottom was a good 5. You could easily have walked those paths. The lay in that was very flat and lifeless. My best guess is it's fake. And I think if it is a fake, my guess that what's going on is that somebody does not want us to take this phenomenon seriously and periodically does very clever fakes to throw off the entire thing. And if you do it using aliens, because UFOs were already laughed at, and everybody knows anybody who thinks about that is crazy, well, you put an alien in the field, and that makes all of us crazy, too. Go ahead.
Is that the disc?
The one with the disc was the Crabwood Tree one, yes. I mean, I don't know. We didn't do all the work on it, so I don't know. I just told you what I do know. You know, it's terrible when they go and you can't do anything more on the science anyhow, because it's gone. The field's been plowed, the stuff's all gone, there's nothing we can do. Go ahead.
I wrote the field about the plasma. It's very interesting. The sun has a cycle of 11 years.
Yes, and there is some correlation in numbers of crop circles and sunspot activity. At least there was as of about 2 years ago. The numbers of crop circles were greater nearer sunspot maximum. Mm-hmm. And as the maximum receded, the numbers fell.
Okay. But why you know this last 3-4 people not why has brought not been before so much?
I am
it's a much now. But the sunspots and the cycles of sun now have been for me not here.
Oh, you mean why don't the crop circles always come? What do I know? I don't know. I don't know. I mean, why do they happen sometimes? I have no idea. If I knew that, I'd be making a lot of money.
The sunspot cycle takes like 20,000.
No, it takes 11. It's an 11-year cycle.
11 years.
And as that cycle wanes, the numbers of crop circles have been going down, and as it reaches maximum again, they have been going up. But there are there's so many things to look at, and we're a small group, and we now have, I think there are 13 scientists involved in BLC now, with different disciplines. Levengood is not doing this plant work much anymore. He published 3 papers, on his work. He really doesn't have any, doesn't know what else to do, and he has other things he's interested in. We are now working mostly with soil people, soil chemists. This summer we're doing a study that's looking at mycorrhizal fungi in the plant roots, because we reason again, if heat is present, then the microbes in the soil are bound to be affected. It may kill some of them. It may cause their reproductive tract to go funny. Well, a guy at UC Davis, University of California at Davis, who's a mycologist, has volunteered his time to do that study. And what I do is take advantage whenever a scientist, a bona fide scientist, is interested because he's seen our published work and he says, oh my God, this is curious. I take advantage of it if I can. Now, I have no idea what we may find, but so far, every new inquiry has produced something that particular scientist cannot explain. And I figure if we do enough of this for enough years, that these layers of inconsistencies will build up, and maybe then the larger community will get it, that there's something real going on. This is not plankton boards, period. I don't know what it is, but I know it isn't plankton boards. And I may be the only person in the world who can say that, coming from both the science and the fact that I watched one happen. There were no planks and boards. You can throw that idea out. There are people who make them, yes. There are people who go in the fields and amuse themselves. They didn't make the one that I saw happen, and they haven't made these others that we've been testing.
Still careful with like joining up with the metaphysical science.
I don't have the time.
Okay.
I have a great deal of regard for other inquiries and other ways of approaching this.
Mm.
And I'm not at all sure that the science will answer all the questions.
Mm.
But you can only do one thing at a time.
Yeah.
It's hard enough to stay focused as it is.
Mm.
And I want to do the physical thing. If we can get an understanding of the physical operation, you guys can then go ahead and
do
the rest.
Baker's geometry experts.
Yeah.
Have
I'm sure they will. Yeah.
It
wasn't tested thoroughly, but that thing, it had expulsion cavities everywhere. It had visible node elongation. And the most interesting thing about Milkwell, that was not on a flat surface. I don't know if you know that. It was on undulating land. It really went like this.
Mm-hmm.
One of my guys measured the circles on the slopes as opposed to the circles that were on flat land. All of the circles on flat land were, in fact, circular. All of the circles on slopes were markedly elliptical.
Mm-hmm.
This is another area. Anybody could do this. Anybody here could do this. You take the measuring stuff there, you wait till you get one on the hillside, and you measure away.
Mm-hmm.
Measure all the diameters. It would produce enormous amounts of data that would be useful. In many of these, in the years gone by when we were surveying them, if you found them on a hill and you measured the ellipse, you discovered that the degree of ellipse matched perfectly the angle of the hill. In other words, the delivery source was directly above, absolutely above, shooting straight down. And the reason you get the ellipse is because the ground is going like this. Enough data and you can prove that point. You know, you photograph the thing, you do the measurements, you do it on enough of them, and you have a new statement you can make about crop circles.
Well, do you post anything of the laser satellite
I'm told by the scientists with whom we work that there is no way to direct microwave radiation over such distances. No way, it is impossible. We are not technically capable of doing it. That's what I'm told. Now, I mean, from a satellite. From a plane hovering over, yes. But there are no planes hovering over these things when they're made.
Mm-hmm.
Microwaves disperse immediately. I mean, they have to be focused, and it's not easy to do. Is that what you meant?
Yeah.
Why do you think the most of them are happening at night? I mean, okay, there are some made in the daytime, but obviously, like 95% are happening at night.
It's not clear that 95% are made at night. It may be not so. There may be quite a larger number made in the daytime. But my instinct tells me that if anything like microwaves, the force that I saw, and if in fact microwaves are involved, it would cook you. And this is another reason I have this notion that maybe there's some kind of consciousness involved. Mm. And it knows human beings aren't generally out in the middle of fields at 3 a.m. And so it's the safest time to do it. Mm. I mean, it's the only rational thing I can come up with. 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, usually, people are in bed or they're not out in the middle of a field. You know about the porcupines that have been flattened. And we found a fox like this once. And there was some other animal, a rabbit, in the Netherlands. I mean, flat and dry, you know, woof. Now, porcupines roll up in a ball when they're scared. If, in fact, those poor creatures could feel it coming and roll up in a ball and they happened to be in the wrong place, I mean, there was nothing left. And from the thing I saw, I wouldn't have wanted to be under that. In fact, you couldn't pay me to be under what I saw. My instinct was to get away from that as fast as I could. Not that I thought it was aimed for me. It wasn't. I had no sense of that. But it just looked so forceful. Very brief, but really a lot of power. The other thing that I know about these things is there is a precision. This phenomenon is capable of absolute precision. It can put it anywhere it intends, I think. And I've seen enough evidence of that over and over again that again says to me, it's got to be aware. It has to have a consciousness to do that. Because I've seen it placed, I mean, on Roberts, that one at Roberts, it was placed dead center between their north and south boundaries. Dead center.
Well, yes, it did. I should have told you this. The most important communication was that it made the crop circles. And Robert didn't think to ask, do you mean the ones right around my house, or do you mean all of them? So we don't know, but he got the impression that they told him they were making a crop circle, that they were going to come back, as they now have repeatedly, and then he also, just his impression, it's not like a telling, just what I said to you, that they're going to come back in large numbers, or in a larger group or something, to a large bunch of people, en masse, in other words, in an effort to startle, was the word he used, not frighten, but to startle humanity into paying attention of something that's important. And he thinks it's the environment, but he's not sure. Could be something else.
Do you know about the battery discharge in karmas in the same crop circle? Do you also hear humming sounds in the same crop circle as the battery discharge? Is there
I don't know if there have been in exactly the same situation. There has been a humming noise sometimes heard. There's been a couple of other noises that have been documented. And of course, batteries fail all the time in crop circles. And it's a very common thing. Keep that there, yeah. I can't hear you. His address?
Yes, an address.
Well, we can see
the photograph.
Yeah.
It's very complicated. I mean, I can tell you how to get there. Go to our site first. It's bltresearch.com. Go to general links on our site. When you get to that, it's a page of all these different formations, sites in other parts of the world. Go to Holland. There's only one link under Holland. Click on that. And the blue page opens up, and you will see UK in the lower right-hand corner. That means English. Click on that, and then another blue screen comes up, and it's right at the top of the screen. That's the new part. There's a brand new thing that just went up. There is a whole bunch of aliens in the new one, or creatures. But down farther in the list, there will be a thing, it was a couple of months ago, and it says, Dutch researcher photographs aliens. That's the original picture. The latest stuff, and there's a whole bunch of stuff that just came out from these reporters who've been coming. It's all the stuff they're getting on their cameras, and that just went up, I think, 2 days ago, 3 days ago. And you see other weird creatures. And the guy from Papua New Guinea is in that series. This naked guy all covered in mud and ash. Yeah, how to get there? Our site first, then general links. Go to general links on the BLT site. That takes you to a list of websites in different countries. Go to Holland. And underneath Holland, there's only one link. Click on that. A blue screen will open up. You'll see UK in the lower right-hand corner. There's a U and a K. It's for English. Click on that, and then you get there. It's a friend in Holland, and he got these pictures off the TV station, which is where Robert's given them. Well, thank you guys for coming. It's been nice to meet all of you.